Hello and welcome to the Majlis Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. Weak, corrupt, and politically unstable, the former Soviet republics of Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan are dismissed as isolated and irrelevant to the outside world. But are they really isolated? Alex Coley and John Hedershaw's hard-hitting book argues that Central Asia is in reality a globalized region with extensive involvement in economics, politics, and security dynamics beyond its borders. This is the bold conclusion of the newly released book called Dictators Without Borders, and we are delighted to have both of the authors on today's show to help us to unpack some of the questions raised in the book. Alex and John, welcome to the Majlis.
Hi there, thank you.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks very much, guys.
Thank you. Very nice to have you. Alex is the director of Columbia University's Harriman Institute, and John Hedershaw is associate professor at the Exeter University in UK. Additionally, I'm joined by my colleague, Bruce Panier, who's the editor of Kishlok Owozi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Majlis again. I got my copy of the book. Those who are listening to us and haven't got their copy of the book yet, I would suggest that you pause the podcast and get your copy first and then come back. Believe me, it will be worth of every penny you spend. So I'm still reading it. There are a lot to learn, and I'm hoping to learn some of the questions during the discussion today. So without further ado, Alex, please grab a microphone. And first of all, tell us, please, how this book came about.
So as all good collaborations, I think there's an interesting story behind this. John and I are both interested in international relations. And actually, John had reviewed my Great Games Local Rules book for the publication International Affairs, published by Chatham House. And in his review of the book, he engaged with a chapter I had on transnational corruption networks. And how the great powers use those. And he had some, you know, really interesting thoughts and comments. And he himself had been doing this great work on how Tajikistan projects itself globally and how it also disembeds itself with a lot of these offshore structures, especially in the case of Talco. So that got us talking a bit more about collaborating on an international relations work that actually made these kinds of hidden offshore global extraterritorial structures front and center, as opposed to just sort of a side chapter or kind of a side comment. And it's been a really engaging and rewarding process.
John?
Yeah, I echo that. I think obviously it's the culmination of research going back, you know, 10, 20 years in some cases, the different chapters, the different stories, different cases that Alex and I have individually been following for some time. And then as you talk more, of course, you spot the patterns from one Central Asian state to another. You spot the global patterns, the certain kind of places and nodes in these networks, the countries in the Caribbean that tend to crop up all the time, certain kinds of practices by Central Asian elites, by company service providers that, you know, enable these flows and these networks to emerge. So, you know, suddenly what is a series of conversations and a series of what initially appeared to be apparently unrelated puzzles and questions kind of come together and you have a book. Yeah. I think that's the way these things emerge.
I think the other driver that really crystallized this for us was all this sort of talk of connectivity. Right. That's been sort of in the air and the new Silk Route and, you know, this kind of constant refrain that Central Asia lacks connectivity. And John and I initially collaborated on a workshop at Columbia a few years ago on Central Asia and the offshore world. And then we solicited some calls for papers. And that was a special issue of Central Asian Survey a couple of years ago. And so that became the nucleus for the book, in which we pulled all these sort of strands together in these various themes, as John elaborated on them.
Bruce, I appreciate your comments, but today I'm in need of your help to get as much as information we can from these two gentlemen about the book. So feel free to jump in whenever you wish to. Alex, coming back to you, in the book, you talk about three myths in Central Asia. Tell us a little bit about those myths, please.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, we sort of identified three common myths or tropes that inform both policymaking and also some scholarly approaches to Central Asia. And, you know, one is this myth of global isolation that I just talked about, right? This idea that somehow Central Asia lacks connectivity, and specifically this idea that Central Asia's development woes, right? Its economic ills are a function of the fact that it's not connected. And, you know, one, this is something that we wanted to push back on and actually sort of identify the principal causes of sort of Central Asian misdevelopment are not the lack of connectivity, they're the wrong kinds of connectivity, right? There are systemic kleptocracy and capital flight through which these societies and countries are looted. And then, you know, with the assistance of this apparatus in the Western states, sort of, you know, funds are taken out of the country. So there's this myth of global isolation. There's this myth of partial liberalization, this other kind of idea that, well, if only Central Asia were to liberalize more, if it were to reform more, there are certainly areas and certain countries that require more reforms. You do have capital controls in places like Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan, for instance. But the liberalization of finance, you know, for elites anyway, you know, has been pursued pretty aggressively. And also the use of offshore structures, the use of shell companies, all of these countries use anonymous corporations to structure major deals and major state operated enterprises and contracts and sales. So I think that's the second sort of myth that's there. It's an idea that there has been financial liberalization. It just hasn't been accompanied by political liberalization the way that we assume. And then the final myth is this idea of that Central Asian politics is kind of localized and a function of sort of local identities and traditions, right? And this sort of harps back to sort of the debate we had about Central Asian clan politics, right? The formal and informal. And I think whatever the merits of that debate, what John and I see is that Central Asian elites are national and local, but they're also global players. And what they do is they disembody themselves from the countries that they actually rule, and they maintain residencies overseas. They maintain bank accounts overseas. They purchase luxury real estates. They engage with international charities and international organizations. So there are as much sort of, I was about to say, global players, right? But the global part of their identity, I think, is obscured by this kind of focus on traditionalism. So we see these three as the main myths that we want to, you know, kind of explode. And I think once we start unpacking these, some of the other arguments flow naturally.
John, so in terms of these different level of liberalization that Alex alluded to as a myth, why we misunderstood the region?
Well, I think, you know, all of these things are big basket terms which encompass a variety of areas in which liberalization and reform can take place. So obviously you have this emphasis on that reform after 1991. And what tends to happen is that people basket these things together and think that if you're going to have economic liberalization, that along with that, political liberalization must come too. And then within those things, you know, that you would have quite specific public sector reform, accountability mechanisms. You'd also have financial liberalization, you know, floating currencies, limited capital controls, this kind of thing. And now all of this, all is kind of liberal. It's all freeing things. It's all enabling movement and flows. And it all more or less should sort of take place in lockstep. So I think one of the things we're trying to do in the book is sort of decouple those things from one another and say that actually you can have financial liberalization in part, but whilst the state has become more authoritarian and that then it's become less liberal, so that these processes aren't in parallel with one another, but sometimes they depart from one another. And I think just to pick up on Alex's points about, you know, and that last point about localism as well, if I may.
Sure.
I think the point is the need to recognize these kind of big stories of Central Asia in the last 25 or 26 years, you can't tell them in their fullest form without paying some attention to these global dynamics. So I think for a period, when I initially started studying the aftermath of the Tajik Civil War, for example, I would not have really thought that these global flows, these global financial dimensions were important. But I now see that they're extremely important in telling the full story of how Tajikistan recovered from the civil war. They're important in telling the story of the political instability in Kyrgyzstan. They're important in telling the story of how Kazakhstan's rise as a major oil and gas power enables certain kinds of corruptions, whether Kazakhstan will fall victim to a resource curse or not. You know, the global and the financial dimension in particular needs to be brought in to understand these things.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had quite a bit of brainstorming about this discussion with Bruce, and this is the question I was suggested by Bruce earlier, that the big part of the book obviously talks about the financial corruption and how the rich and powerful move funds outside their countries. Could you please walk us through the process, some examples of the process of how entities or individuals move money outside the country, Alex?
Yeah, certainly. So I think one thing that's striking to me, and I think, you know, and again, you know, my own work previously on some of the fuel contracts in Kyrgyzstan very much mirror John's research on what he was seeing in the post-conflict settlement in Tajikistan, is that the playbook tends to be similar. What we tend to get are elites with access to state assets, right? Using offshore companies, shell companies that are registered overseas to parse the ownership of these assets, to obscure then what happens with these revenues later and these sales, and then to sort of structure deals in a way that enables sort of future payoffs. So a lot of this is murky and opaque, but once we start uncovering through some of these investigations, for instance, these arbitration hearings, these transcripts, or these, you know, Foreign Corrupt Practices Acts settlements, we also see that a lot of these schemes are quite deliberate and are quite sequenced. So let's take the example of telecoms in Uzbekistan, right, in which we have a chapter. What's fascinating about the Uzbek case is that, like, we now know from pretty much about more than a half a dozen investigations that were carried out in the Netherlands, in Sweden, in the U.S., and now from sort of court documents on settlements, that international telecom companies who wanted to access the Uzbek market had basically to provide a series of payoffs to insiders connected with the presidential family. And that person has now been identified by Dutch prosecutors as Gulnara Karimova, the former president's daughter. What Karimova did and the way the scheme operated was that there were new shell companies that were set up just a few weeks before the first tender for a license, say like a 3G license. And what makes the sector especially vulnerable to corruption is that you have these different licenses for these different standards. So this company called Takalamp that was incorporated overseas in Gibraltar and opened by an associate of Gulnara Karimova. That was the vehicle through which a lot of these payments between foreign telecoms were structured and sequenced and then created these sort of complex sort of buyback schemes. So in general, that's how it works. You don't have, you know, kind of, you know, these cases of sort of, you know, kind of direct payments. Rather, they're mediated by shell companies with opaque structures. Usually there's a time series sort of element to it in which the shell companies add shares or buy back shares in a sort of a complicated layering process. And then the ultimate destination of the funds is always difficult to track down. And that's when you get into sort of international money laundering probes. But that tends to be the playbook. The other thing I would say is that that kind of sequence with telecoms is something similar that we've seen, for instance, in Chinese energy companies operating in the region. Or when you think about the Manas fuel contracts themselves, the main contract went to, again, an opaque Gibraltar registered entity MINA Corps at the time that had all sorts of complicated sort of networks and ultimately was tied into a fuel smuggling ring from Siberia. So that's how it tends to operate in all of these deals.
I know, Bruce, you are fascinated with those corruption cases involving Gulnara Karimova in Uzbekistan. Please jump in with comments and questions here.
I wasn't so fascinated. She's kind of a strange creature. Although I was watching the case, it didn't displease me the way that it was going, to say the least, because she's been a rather odious figure in Uzbekistan for some time. But I am kind of curious. One of the questions that I've had for a long time is that these are relatively young states. I mean, they're only 25 years old. These people that were in power, certainly the case of Nazarbayev Karimov in Uzbekistan when he was there, I mean, they came out of the Soviet Union. They wouldn't have been savvy about these kind of things. They wouldn't have known about these things. I know that in your book you have you devote some attention to the facilitators of this, and this is what I'm really curious about. Even within the Soviet Union, there wouldn't have been many people upon the collapse that would have known about these kind of offshore shell companies and how you do this stuff. So somewhere along the line, either someone approached these people or they managed to link up with the right people. Can you speak a little bit about, and I guess I'll start with John, can you speak a little bit about that, what I would term the outside facilitators, the people who meet up with these government officials and say, look, this is how we can get this thing done and how you can get money out of the country?
Yeah, sure. And I guess technically we call them intermediaries who facilitate these networks and exchanges. They can be of different types. Some of them are legal. Some of them are financial. Some of them might be reputation managers or security consultants, because we also look at aspects of this which are non-financial. They're not even directly related to business. They're about, you know, tracking down political enemies overseas in order to consolidate power. So these are the global dimensions. So amongst all that, there's a whole variety of figures who can enable this. And obviously, you're absolutely right that whilst today, you know, 25, 26 years on, almost since the end of the Soviet Union, you do have some fairly savvy operators within Central Asian states who are very well used to engaging in the sort of international business networks and the like. We could name a few names, but, you know, I think that's pretty well established. In the early 1990s, that wasn't true. So you had some, you know, initially, I think maybe there were some interesting and quite specific and rare cases of individuals that were able to do this. So, I mean, the classic and most well-known case is James Giffen, whose story is covered very well in Steve Levine's book, The Oil and the Glory, from some years ago. So we don't cover that in detail in the book. But, you know, him entering Kazakhstan to set up oil and gas deals from the late 1980s, actually, and really just introducing the new Kazakh government to that world. But, you know, the quintessential broker, really. But in the book, we explore, you know, there's some classic cases such as the partnership between Yevgeny Gurevich, who worked as a sort of banker and financier with a group in Kyrgyzstan in which Maxim Bakiyev was involved. In Tajikistan, a very interesting case of trying to get the aluminium company back online during the civil war, and a Tajik businessman in the mid-1990s who did have these international business connections was the person who did that initially, before then the Rahmon regime essentially pushed that management group out, really took it over themselves through their Orion Bank. So, you know, what you've got is one or two key individuals early on who are able to set these things up. But then eventually the senior people in the regimes learn, I think, and these things become incorporated and become sort of mainstreamed and more commonplace in how Central Asian states function.
Related question to that is, Alex, it's not only financial institutions you talk about in details in your book, and also the way how the political institutions of the West, including court systems, are manipulated by Central Asian corrupt figures. I remember from your talk at the NET the other day that you were talking about how the extradition of family members of dissidents are taking place and how Interpols are used by some of those Central Asian corrupt figures. Take us through, please, with some examples of how this is happening.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I think one of the arguments that runs through the book is that in this quest to go after political opponents who have fled overseas, the Central Asian governments start using certain international institutions and foreign policy tools for these kinds of political purposes, right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to straight commercial purposes or, you know, the normal foreign affairs of the state. Mm-hmm. So one of these institutions is Interpol and the Red Notice system. You know, Interpol, the Red Notice, is as close to an international arrest warrant as we have, really. And by tagging political opponents with accusations like they're terrorists or that they have been involved in money laundering, right? This constricts the ability of political opponents to move overseas, right? To catch, you know, airplanes or even trains, you know, and so their mobility is restricted, and oftentimes they are detained and then processed through the legal system of these various countries in which they find themselves. So that's one. The other thing that we have is the use of, you know, the normal process of sort of, you know, extraditions, by which, again, you accuse political opponents of having committed these crimes. You ask for them to be extradited back home. That becomes very tricky if you're an authoritarian, because most countries in the West adhere to international standards and international conventions against sending asylum seekers back to countries where they might be tortured. So that becomes tricky. But if you can't do that with extradition treaties, then you also try and tie them up in proceedings that relate to financial dealings, right? You try and level arbitration hearings against them. You take them to court over sort of the disputes over things like embezzlement of assets or ownership structures or the failure to disclose. So it's not one particular mechanism. It's the kind of use of this, you know, type of governance toolkit, both on the political side and the commercial side, to identify opponents, to sue them, to try and tie them up in court if you can't actually get them extradited back.
John, coming to you, so now this also means that in a way that those corrupt figures from our region, Central Asia, uses some of these democratic institutions as a one tool in their toolbox to reach their objectives, correct? So don't they, I mean, those institutions realize that. So how do they miss the point?
I mean, there's different, we need to make distinctions here between people who are directly making money off providing financial services, which in some cases are enabling money laundering, they're at least enabling secrecy of finance for some of the most authoritarian regimes in the world. Okay, so there are banks, there are intermediaries, there are even people like due diligence advisors that have to come and often provide very ambiguous judgments about whether there's a risk of corruption. And all of those people have a vested interest in taking this business, they're making money out of it, and in hedging their bets, one could say, in terms of designating this as a real corruption risk. Now, that brings into the second level, which is the regulators, and I think your question probably is best addressed to them, where there are global anti-money laundering rules. There are international human rights treaties. Right. Interpol itself, by its constitution, should not be being used for these politically motivated purposes that Alex was just describing and that we cover in particular in one chapter, in the last chapter of the book. So, you know, the question then is, how is this happening? How is Interpol being abused? How is the anti-money laundering regime not being properly implemented? And I think the question, for me, the core issue there is that a great deal of this relies on self-regulation and the particular way it's implemented either by the service providers, in the case of the financial matters, or by the national police services in different countries, say with regard to Interpol red notices. So, you know, in terms of, say, money laundering into real estate, most countries require, so it's essentially a form of self-regulation, where this is certainly true in the UK, I know, where there's a lot of laundering into the London property market, where real estate agents are simply supposed to report if they have a suspicion. But there's been a few studies now that really show that there's a pretty high bar that they seem, in fact, to place in terms of reporting suspicion. And I think very often, you know, obviously they have an interest not to report that, And the authorities, the National Crime Agency in the UK, for example, that might be kind of overall responsible for this, has very few resources and even lacks the mandate to really follow up and check whether these things are being done properly. And similarly, one could say, with regard to, say, the security aspects and the Interpol red notices, relies a great deal on national police forces having the capacity to check this out, not simply to arrest someone and presume to extradite them on the basis of a red notice, but to go through a series of proper checks to ascertain whether this is a legitimate request for arrest and extradition or not. And eventually, most countries, say, within in most sort of OECD states, in most developed states, certainly in most democracies, would have such checks. But some places are much weaker than you'd imagine. Some are much more likely to arrest people. Some are much more likely to, and they have many of them have very little capacity to really understand, you know, the context of Central Asia. So, yeah, I mean, I think there are a variety of reasons here, but they're essentially about the fact that the regulatory system is not fully and properly enforced, and it requires the interpretation and performance of local agencies, and in some cases requires the sort of self-regulation of businesses and individuals who have an interest in keeping this business going, in taking the money and not in questioning it or reporting their clients to the authorities.
Well, thank you.
This would be a good time to mention, too, that Exeter is assembling a database, right, on people outside the country concerning the Interpol red notices. Is this not true?
Yeah, that's right. The Central Asian Political Exiles database. So one of the things we look there is the red notices, the use of international arrest warrants. We drew on that database to do Chapter 7 of the book. You know, actually, the arrest warrants is really only the first stage through which this, what we call extraterritorial security, the way this works. So, you know, putting someone on notice is one thing, and in some cases it may stop there, but we looked at cases where it goes much further, where people are detained, where a great deal of resources of the state are from countries, particularly Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, that have been very active in this area, tracking their exiles overseas, individuals being arrested, incarcerated, attacked, and in some cases assassinated under very suspicious circumstances. So yeah, we track all this at the Central Asian Political Exiles database, which is on our website at Exeter.
Thank you very much, John. Let's talk a little bit about these loopholes in a greater details after the break. Hey everyone, before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like Majlis podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Gandhara Podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Pakistan and Afghanistan from local perspective. And the podcast is published in every second week on Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Gandhara website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. First, let me recap the discussion that today on the Majlis Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty Central Asia podcast, we are discussing Alex Coley and John Hodershaw's new book on Central Asia called Dictators Without Border. Joining me in the discussion are the authors of the book, Alex Coley, director of the Columbia University's Harriman Institute, John Hodershaw, associate professor at the Exeter University, and Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlok Owozi, a Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, gentlemen, to the Majlis. Before we get into the consequences of this practice, just to clarify one thing, which of these Central Asian countries or the figures were more advanced in using these loopholes to play with Western institutions than the others, Alex?
I don't know if I think of it as more advanced or not, Mohammed, more that you see different sides of this and you see different milieus of elites, right? So let's take an example, Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, for instance, right? So in the case of Kazakhstan, you have, you know, what's approaching a medium income country, you have quite a sizable elite, a transnational elite, right? Who live both in Almaty and Astana, but also in London, in New York, in Paris. And so, for instance, you know, one of the things that we found is that Kazakhs are proportionally high recipients of so-called investment visas, right? Certainly from, you know, the UK under the initial tier one investment visa, I think from data 2009-2013, 41 Kazakhs, they were sixth on the list. So they're quite globalized, they're quite internationalized, right? And as a type of community. Uzbekistan, on the other hand, part of what makes the Karimova case so interesting is that you're talking about a relatively closed country, right, where the kinds of mobility and exit opportunities are really restricted to just, or were restricted to, handfuls of elites. And in some ways, in the Uzbek case, it's the contrast between Karimova and her associates being so dispersed globally, right? Having assets scattered across such, you know, a landscape that went from Switzerland to France to New York, as well as her sort of, you know, diplomatic kinds of affairs, contrasting that with how closed off Uzbekistan was as a society, right? You know, politically, you know, the exit visas, the currency controls, you know, the lack of ability to sort of travel. So I think the global dimension has different meanings in different countries, right? I'll give you one other example. In Kyrgyzstan, right? So this is a place where you've had, you know, liberalization and financial liberalization. You know, part of what NGOs like Global Witness have looked at is, you know, the possibility that, you know, banks and financial sectors operating in Kyrgyzstan didn't have proper supervision or regulatory oversight, and instead we're dealing with masses of sort of shell companies overseas. That's not something that could happen in Turkmenistan, right? Because Turkmenistan doesn't have the same internal liberal banking. So I think there's, you know, this plays out differently in different flavors across the countries, right? I think the types of links vary. So I don't think of it as advanced or not. I think of it more as, you know, the different connections that are made and whether it's sort of a concentrated elite or more diffusely.
Yeah, it's interesting that you touched that. In general, there wasn't much discussion about Turkmenistan. I assume my question goes to John here. I assume that it doesn't mean that Ashgabat is out of this dirty business. What's your take?
No, I think that's right. I mean, just to pick up on one thing that Alex said there as well, where I think, you know, for Kyrgyzstan really is the extreme case, probably extreme opposite to Turkmenistan, actually, where, you know, Kyrgyzstan for a few years actually became a node in this offshore financial system. So whereas Kazakhstan was probably pushing much more money offshore in absolute terms, in Kyrgyzstan, you know, the money was flowing through Kyrgyzstan from other parts of the world and out of Kyrgyzstan to other parts of the world. So, you know, we shouldn't generalize about Central Asia in terms of the different positions that different states at different times, because this is no longer true of Kyrgyzstan, took in this whole offshore network that we describe. So, yeah, Turkmenistan is somewhat different. And I think it was a little disappointing for us that we didn't feel possible that we could do a sort of Turkmenistan case. Global Witness, which is one of the NGOs already mentioned, that we've, you know, we've worked with, talked to people there for some time and built on some of their research with regard to, say, Kyrgyzstan. They did this study on the financial arrangements that Turkmenistan had, particularly with Deutsche Bank, that I'm sure you remember, Mohammed. This is about 10 years ago now, really. As the Niyazov regime ended, it became apparent what was happening. You know, was discussed somewhat at that time. So I think it's obviously with Turkmenistan having a very closed economy, having very limited sets of business relations with key chosen preferred partners, it's easier to keep things under wraps. And this highlights, I think, one of the whole challenges of doing research in this area, which is that you have to work with cases that become apparent, that are then detailed, usually in court records, sometimes also in excellent investigative reporting, in things like data dumps from offshore companies, in dumps of WikiLeaks type of US telegrams, things like this. And you can then put together a picture. Turkmenistan, after that particular case around Deutsche Bank, there's been very little in the public domain, and not really enough to put together a sort of single case study focused around a particular business. although, you know, there are other people doing work in this field, and I think, you know, one can only hope that more cases will come out with regard to Kyrgyzstan as well as with regard to Turkmenistan as well as the other Central Asian states.
Bruce, you are so quiet today.
No, I'm listening. This is I want to learn from this. So, but I do have a couple of questions that I wanted to ask. You know, we were talking about the Interpol notices and everything like that, but it seems like some of the criminals are also able to use this. Criminal is not the word I want to use here exactly, but Mukhtar Ablazov is one interesting example, I think. But before him, even Akhajan Kajageldin is another. Now, here's people who were part of the Kazakh government, made a lot of money and managed to get out of the country and find protection, some degree of protection in the West, and hold on to a sizable amount of the money that they arrived with. And I'm very curious because there's certainly cause to believe that some of these finances that they left the country with were amount to ill-gotten gains. And yet, yeah, you know, for the reasons you mentioned, that the, you know, we don't want to hand them over to someone who's going to be where they're a country where they're going to be tortured or something, which is fine. But on the other hand, they don't seem to be exactly guiltless in this either. Right. How does that work, where you take somebody in like this, they're using the system just as much as the leadership of some of these countries do to hunt down their political opponents, aren't they?
So, Bruce, this is a really excellent question. It gets at the heart of, you know, some of the very many moral and ethical dilemmas that we struggle with in the book, that, you know, part of what we see is, you know, this dynamic in which if you were a former regime insider, right, and you had access to a ministry or an insider privatization deal, and you have now fallen out, you know, with the current regime, you know, persona non grata, and you leave, you know, part of the paradox of fleeing an authoritarian regime is you have a pretty strong case for political asylum, right?
Yeah.
And any claims against you in terms of, you know, actual accusations of fraud or embezzlement are going to be mediated and complicated by you invoking the politicization of the process, right? And that, I think, you know, you see the Ablyasov case is a really fascinating one because there are two really different narratives on display here, right? The Kazakh government insists that Ablyasov embezzled billions of dollars through the BTA bank, which, you know, they had to take over, that, you know, a number of legal judgments in the UK found him, for example, in contempt of court for, you know, failing to sort of, you know, fully disclose the extent of his global assets, right? So they see this as a clear-cut case of a fugitive who's kind of on the run and he's not, you know, coming to justice. Ablyasov and his defenders and a lot of human rights activists who have, you know, taken an interest in the case point out that, no, this guy actually became a crusader against the Nazarbayev regime, that the move on BTA by the Sovereign Wealth Fund was politically motivated. And they say part of the reason that he had to conceal a lot of his dealings in these sort of shell companies were, in fact, because he was scared of the political ramifications of being identified as an owner by the Nazarbayev regime. And then while in exile, sort of, you know, he was reported to have funded things like, you know, independent media and sort of satellite TV and projected that. So these are two really different narratives about, you know, is Ablyasov a Democrat in exile or is he an economic criminal and fugitive, right? And these two different parts of the narrative are pushed by the sides. But I think the fundamental paradox that we identify in this book is, in authoritarian societies, those who peel off, right, former, you know, political exiles, former regime insiders, seem to have a ready-made path to living in exile and being granted asylum by the West's very own asylum laws.
Interesting. Either dealing with the legal issues involving Ablyasov and some other names, or issues related to authorities' intention to move money out from their country to outside institutions, they are continue to playing with the type of loopholes that we were talking about. So with that, some Western institutions also running the risk of undermining their own principles. So, you know, we also have to end our discussion. So in that case, have there been any efforts John, to tighten the laws, to close some of the loopholes that Central Asian figures have been able to use to manipulate for their own objectives?
There have. I think the general problem is the one that Alex describes, where, and as you also indicate yourself, where the global governance just hasn't kept up with these business practices and these political practices as well. They're all, you know, I mean, I think you just English legal discourse cannot adjudicate on these things. I've sat in courts in London where a judge has been asked to make a decision on a particular matter of business in Tajikistan or Kyrgyzstan, and they just don't have the information at hand, and that form of deliberation is not sufficient to really assess what is occurring, quite frankly. So, you know, one would hope, of course, that there would be global institutions that could do this. Personally, in my idealistic imaginary world, I'd love it if the International Criminal Court extended to political economic crimes occurring by oligarchs, and that we could use that criminal justice system and detention that way to prosecute such people without having them to extradite people to places where they would not get a fair trial. But that clearly we don't have that. So what has been happening? That was your question to get back to it. I mean, I think there is already, first of all, a certain amount of anti-money laundering legislation in place. There's, you know, some very significant legal instruments with extraterritorial power, like the US Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And when that's used and enforced properly, it can be a very powerful instrument for revealing some of these cases. But obviously, it's in effect, it's used very rarely in terms of the whole number of possible cases into which it could be applied. I think a number of us maybe got a little optimistic for a period following the publication of the Panama Papers, where there was a big push, and the whole question of whether you'd have a global agreement, or certainly a near-to global agreement, to have the publication of the beneficial owners of companies, of offshore companies. This is the key thing. You know, one of the key aspects of all this is secrecy. We don't know. If we knew, people like you could report on it. We could write books on it. We could all speak about it openly without fear of being sued. But very often we don't, because of the very secret nature of these companies. So, you know, campaigning organizations have been pushing for some time to have a public registry, including in offshore havens in places like British Virgin Islands, where this would be clear. So I think in the UK, the anti-corruption summit of David Cameron was sort of genuflecting in that direction, but didn't quite go that far. And then, of course, political events happened, and the steam seems to have been taken out of that initiative. So, I mean, I don't think we can say right now the direction of travel is towards better and greater regulation and better and greater enforcement of the existing regulation. But I do think it's not an entirely negative picture. There are legal instruments and processes in place to deal with this. It's just they're not always effectively enforced.
You know, it's.
Can I get one question in? I know we're running out of time, but yeah, I want to get one question in, or actually ask for some for John and Alex, your opinions on this. Is the West sometimes sending the wrong message? I mean, in the Kazakhgate trial, and we mentioned James Giffen earlier, but also in the Karimova investigation, I believe in Switzerland too, they release some of these documents. You get some of the information about what the hearing is, but the principal people involved, the ones that we know get the money, are never specifically named in the court documents. In fact, it's prohibited. In the Kazakhgate trial, Nazarbayev, I believe he was just referred to as B. Everyone assumed that was him, but his name never appeared in any of the documents. And it was the same thing with Karimova during these hearings, too. Are there people who are just untouchable for diplomatic reasons, even though they might be greatly corrupt? There's something, you know, I mean, the Kazakhgate trial was in the U.S. and the other and the Karimova trial in Switzerland. So here's two different countries where they won't name the person who's the recipient of some of this money because seemingly they're just too important. Is that your impression?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it has to do also with terms of settlements that, you know, I think for regulators and prosecutors, you know, getting to the point where you name senior official A and senior official B, or senior official A, who is also a relative to the president, is pretty much good enough and doesn't carry the same kinds of or create the same kinds of, you know, political and legal complications as outright sort of naming them. But, you know, it comes out in drips and drabs. I mean, to me, the other disturbing part, I mean, not to minimize that issue, Bruce, the disturbing part of the Kazakhgate trial and verdict was that the presiding judge, Pauly, basically allowed this public authority defense that Giffen said, you know, that he was acting on behalf of all these U.S. government interests and agencies, right, and security and intelligence agencies, and says that's a perfectly fine defense, right, after years of sort of, you know, the trial being halted over sort of classification procedures and so forth. And so I think the message that is sent by a lot of these trials is, you know, there's, again, extraterritorial justice, but it's also sort of selective that, oh, somehow if you're pursuing U.S. national interests or security interests, you know, it's totally okay to set up some of these schemes. And I think, you know, that's part of sort of what we see here is that, yes, we do have laws and we do have rules, and sometimes they're enforced. But even within this system, you see a real kind of, you know, selectivity of justice. So I totally agree with what John said. We actually have individually a number of instruments that we could use if we had the commitment to sort of, you know, greater justice and greater transparency in coming down on these things. But politics always complicates, right? And you actually see politics also complicate in the courtroom as well.
Okay. So to conclude the debate, so what's the biggest takeaway from this great book? And in few simple words, John.
Central Asia is global, and I think we need to stop thinking about it as being a particular obscure place with its particular story. You know, what is unique about Central Asia is that it, well, not unique, but is unusual that the states became independent very late in world history, and they became independent in an era of globalization, and therefore the states reflect that reality. And I think we should just be cognizant of the fact that, you know, this boundary between what's going on inside and what's going on outside is to be broken down. And that means a lot of these moral frameworks that we have about corruption taking place over there. And in Western countries, there's a lot of emphasis placed on how we solve corruption there without recognizing that we ourselves are part of that corruption. We ourselves are enabling that through our loose laws and through our lack of enforcement of our own laws. So there really does need to be a period of reflection on that, I think, and a recognition, and that requires us to sort of change ourselves so much as sort of hectoring and preaching about Central Asian countries.
Okay, Alex, final point?
No, I think that's exactly you know, part of the take-home message of the book, that these global networks in which Central Asia and Central Asian elites parse their personalities and their country's sovereignty and their country's assets has been enabled and is supported by our own rules, our own norms, our own professional practices. So part of the purpose of the book and the take-home message is as much a mirror on how we facilitate these extraterritorial spaces for these financial transfers and for these extraterritorial authoritarian types of attacks. It's as much about us as its actual sort of use and abuse by Central Asian authoritarian elites.
Thank you very much, Bruce. This somehow takes us to the end of the debate, unless you have a point to raise.
No. We've used up a lot of these gentlemen's time already, but I'm absolutely grateful for this. This has been a fantastic conversation, and for once, I didn't have to say hardly anything at all. So I'm also grateful for that. Thank you.
Thank you very much for insightful comments, Alex Cooley, director of Columbia University's Harriman Institute, John Hederja, associate professor at the Exeter University, and also Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Awazi, Central Asia Blogs, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, for joining us today in the discussion.
Thanks very much, Mohammed. Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.